And Radio Derb is on the air. Yes, listeners, this is your prodigally genial host, John Derbyshire, reporting to you once again from my refuge here in the sun-kissed Aegean after a couple of weeks on the road. I'm sorry to say that, as usual, after a few days away, I find the studio in a state of disorder. There's obviously been some partying going on here with the young men from the village. I'm finding empty ouzo bottles in odd corners, that sort of thing. I have imposed level 3 discipline on the staff here and set the girls to clean up duties. I shall have things shipshape in no time. Meanwhile, let's see what's been happening in the news. Back in 1973, French author Jean Raspail wrote a novel titled Camp of the Saints, in which France is overrun by boat people from India, and the French are too humane to resist the invasion. The plot is a bit implausible. I mean, it's a long way from India to France, and India, even back in the 1970s, wasn't doing too badly. Someone's told me, however, that Monsieur Raspail made the invading hordes Indian rather than African because he didn't want to offend racial sensitivities too much. Well, perhaps he should have been more forthright. There's an invasion of Europe building up, all right, and it is African, not Indian. With the collapse of authority in Libya, Egypt, and Tunisia, and the endless civil war in Syria, and the ease of modern travel, even across the Sahara Desert from south to north, desperate and impoverished people from Africa and the Middle East are gathering on the south shores of the Mediterranean. In the first 3 months of this year, 11,000 people made it across the Mediterranean just to Italy, according to an Italian government official. He added that, quote, between 300,000 and 600,000 people are on the other side of the Mediterranean, on the North African coastline, waiting to cross sooner or later. Spain has similar problems with its little patches of territory in Morocco, on the North African coast. They're surrounded by 20-foot-high fences, but there are now regular news stories about hundreds of Africans, mostly from south of the Sahara, storming the fences and sometimes successfully climbing over them into European territory. These stories are only going to get worse. The comfortable, rule-governed, low-fertility welfare states of Europe, and that's not so much Italy and Spain, but Northern Europe, these places are paradise for young people from chaotic, high-fertility countries like Mali, Niger and Chad, bursting at the seams with people they can't feed, educate or employ. Humanitarianism's coming under increasing strain. Read the comments to the news stories about these invasions in the European papers. I think Jean Raspail got it wrong. At some point, the European people will insist their governments act to stop their countries being overrun. Australia is already setting an example, using their navy to turn back boat people from Indonesia. This won't end well. Boko Haram? The first time I heard about them, I misheard and assumed that the news announcer was talking about Procol Harum, the late 1960s London rock band. We skip the light fandango. Turns cartwheels across the floor. I was feeling kind of seasick. The crowd called out for me. bliss was it in that dawn to be alive. To be young was very heaven. I confess I liked Procol Harum, although from this distance in time they look a bit silly and pretentious, like a lot of what we thought was cool in the 60s. Someone at the International Astronomical Union must have liked them too. Procol Harum has an asteroid named after them. No kidding. There's your useless fact of the month, brought to you by Radio Derb. Sorry, I didn't mean to bleed nostalgia on yous. What was my topic here? Oh yes, Boko Haram. Nothing to do with the summer of love. Boko Haram is a black Islamist gang operating in northern Nigeria. The words Boko Haram mean Western education is forbidden in the local language. These Islamists especially don't like women getting a Western education, or any kind of education, once they're of childbearing age. They accordingly kidnapped 200 or so teenage girls from a boarding school in the region, April 14th. In a video released a few days ago, the leader of Boko Haram, whose name I can't be bothered to look up, but I'll bet is Mohammed something or other, the leader said he planned to sell the students. He opined that the girls should not have been in school anyway, but rather should get married. From a narrowly demographic point of view, Mohammed is on safe ground there. If it's true that demography is destiny, 200 teenage girls popping out babies for Allah beats the same number of maidens studying AP calculus. The problem with Mohammed's strategy is that AP calculus gets you some spiffy technology, so that those of us who favour it end up as the first person pronoun in Hilaire Belloc's lines about colonial warfare. Whatever happens, we have got the Maxim gun, and they have not. Of course, you don't just need the calculus geeks to design your weapon, you also need the will to use it. That's a separate topic which I'll leave you to discuss among yourselves. The relevance of this for US politics is that our ruling classes are stirred up about the Nigerian kidnappings. My Thursday New York Post, which I have delivered by drone from the Greek mainland, featured on its front cover a picture of Michelle Obama wearing her concerned face and holding up a card saying, "Bring back our girls." This first-person pronoun I have a problem with. Our girls? How are they yours, ma'am? Who are the we you derive that our from? Obviously not we Americans, since, so far as I can determine, the missing lassies are all Nigerian citizens. We Negroes? No, it can't possibly be the case that Mrs. Obama is that ethnocentric. Unthinkable. We progressive women of the world is probably closer to what the First Lady's thinking. That would be fair enough, but for the fact that Mrs. Obama is the First Lady. That makes it appear that by referring to the kidnappees as our girls, she sees them as being the concern of the United States, which they are not, and should not be. Private citizens of a humanitarian inclination may feel distressed for the kidnapped girls, and should of course do anything lawful they can think of to help them. But this is not government business. Not unless you think everything is government business, in which case you have plenty of company, but the company doesn't include me. No doubt dire things are happening to schoolgirls all over the world, not just in Nigeria, but in North Korea, Nicaragua, Namibia and Nepal too. There are charities you can subscribe to for helping them, But if you think it's the business of our federal government, you'd better pony up for a whole lot more federal government to take care of it all. The New York Post, which used to be a sensible newspaper, is on board with Mrs. Obama's possessive pronoun. Quote from their editorial. These terrified girls in Nigeria have become our girls, and if we don't regard them the same way we would 300 girls from Brooklyn or Chicago who had been abducted from their school by Islamist terrorists, the horrors we see in Africa today will become America's horror tomorrow. End quote. Good grief. I'm supposed to regard Nigerian schoolgirls with the same concern I'd have for American schoolgirls? I flatly refuse to do so. In fact, I refuse to give a damn about what people in the third world are doing to each other, unless it impacts my country's national interests in some obvious way. Screw the third world. As for the horrors we see in Africa today will become America's horror tomorrow, well, they might, if we're such fools as to let crazy Islamists into our country. Which, as a matter of fact, we are, via our feckless immigration policies and fraud-riddled refugee resettlement programs. If you let all the world's crazy lunatics come settle in your country, then yes, other countries' crazy lunatic problems will become your problems. And Mrs. Obama and the New York Post editorialists will have a point. The solution is sensible, strict immigration policies. Will the New York Post editorialise for that? Will Mrs. Obama hold up a card for that? Don't hold your breath. If the 60s doesn't flip your nostalgia switch, how about the 90s? You remember the 90s. Joey Buttafuoco, Rodney King, Seinfeld, Boris Yeltsin, Titanic, O.J. Simpson, Harry Potter, Married with Children, Windows NT. Ah, the 90s. We got a little reminder of the 90s last week when Monica Lewinsky opened her mouth in public for the first time in 10 years to write an article for Vanity Fair magazine. The actual article doesn't hit the newsstands until May 13th, but extracts have been released to whet our appetites, to get our saliva flowing. Well, to whet some people's appetites anyway. Personally, if an angel had told me 15 years ago that I was going to make it clear through to the Garden of Rest without ever hearing Ms. Lewinsky's name again, I would have gone down on my knees in gratitude. To judge from the extracts, Ms. Lewinsky doesn't have anything new to tell us. She feels sorry for herself. Quote, "Sure, my boss took advantage of me, but I will always remain firm on this point. It was a consensual relationship. Any abuse came in the aftermath, when I was made a scapegoat in order to protect his powerful position." End quote. Well, yeah, but if you'd kept your hand on your halfpenny, excuse an old British expression, and minded your virtue, you wouldn't have been anybody's scapegoat, and would have left the White House without a stain on your character. Ms. Lewinsky claims that after the scandal, quote, "I turned down offers that would have earned me more than $10 million because they didn't feel like the right thing to do," end quote. I find that hard to swallow. Putting out for the president in the Oval Office felt like the right thing to do, but talking about it for money didn't. And Ms. Lewinsky did, in fact, submit to a prime-time interview with Barbara Walters, for which I presume she was paid. And she hosted a cheesy TV dating show, for which ditto, and took part in an HBO documentary about herself, and pitched for a diet company. Perhaps she just can't get her tongue around saying that she wishes she'd made more of her celebrity while it lasted. There have been some deep speculations by former Second Lady Lynn Cheney, for example, that Ms. Lewinsky's recent re-emergence has been engineered by the Clintons to clear the air before Mrs. Clinton announces a 2016 bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. I wouldn't be a bit surprised. As I have noted before, Mrs. Clinton brings to my mind Dr. Johnson's remark about Alexander Pope, quote, "He could not drink tea without a stratagem." Supporting Mrs. Cheney's speculation is the fact that back in February, we learned from a close friend of Mrs. Clinton that Hillary had referred to Ms. Lewinsky during her White House years as, quote, "a narcissistic loony tune." That seems to have stuck in Monica's throat. Quote, "If that's the worst thing she said, I should be so lucky." If it's truly the case that the Clintons are behind all this, though, I doubt it will do them much good. It's going to take more than a little air clearing to make Mrs. Clinton a plausible candidate after her lackluster performance as a senator and her even less than lackluster spell heading up the State Department. So, nice try, Mrs. Clinton, but no cigar. There, I got through a whole segment on Lewinsky and the Clintons without any tasteless double entendres or off-colour allusions. I'm pretty sure I did anyway. Speaking of Hillary Clinton, here's a thing that she said back in January of 2000. Quote, "Marriage has got historic religious and moral content that goes back to the beginning of time, and I think a marriage is, as a marriage has always been, between a man and a woman." End quote. Nothing very surprising about that. Pretty much any American could have said the same thing in all sincerity 14 years ago. There has perhaps never in human history been such a dramatic reversal in public opinion over such a short space of time as there has been this past decade on same-sex marriage. This complete redefinition of a fundamental social institution has been cultural Marxism's greatest triumph. Okay, that's what Mrs. Clinton said 14 years ago. Here is the present-day news story. It follows on from the dismissal recently of Mozilla CEO Bernard Eich for having donated money in support of California Proposition 8, banning same-sex marriage in the state. Just to remind you, Proposition 8 was passed by California voters 52-48%, just 5.5 years ago. By California voters. Well, the Media Research Center, which does good work on the traditionalist conservative beat, sent a reporter to the campus of George Mason University, down there by Fairfax, Virginia. The reporter read out that quote to random students and asked them who they thought might have said it.
Who said that?
A man and a woman. Well, I'd have to say probably someone conservative, but I have no idea.
Who would you guess said that?
I don't know, Rick Perry.
Someone who's extremely religious, I guess.
Okay.
Maybe someone who's really Catholic.
Any Republican.
Any Republican.
Probably a conservative, I would assume.
Rick Santorum.
Rick Santorum, very socially conservative
yes.
guy.
Oh, God. George Bush.
A Republican.
Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney.
Was it Mitt Romney?
No, Mitt Romney, so that would be somebody you could imagine saying something like
yes.
that.
Maybe Mitt Romney or Paul Rand.
Paul Rand? Okay, I've heard Paul Rand,
okay.
but he probably would say right. something like that.
When the reporter asked students if they would be okay with a person who holds those views speaking on campus, several said they would not. What left liberal politicians felt it necessary to take a stand against 14 years ago? What California voters expressed themselves opposed to 5.5 years ago is now ironclad social orthodoxy. Intelligent young people at a good quality university are so locked into it, they would ban from their campus those who disagree. If the unthinkable can become the indisputable that fast, what does the future have in store? What that seems bizarre, freakish, or out of bounds today will be conventional wisdom among the college students of 2028. Bestiality? Necrophilia? Human sacrifice? I guess we shall find out. Whatever it is, I'll guarantee that ambitious politicians who'd speak sternly against it, if asked today, will be enthusiastically in favour when the time comes. Their thinking will have evolved, you see? Some years ago, I wrote a piece with the title Minoritarianism, around the question, how far should society go to accommodate the wishes of minorities? Here was my answer, quote from myself. In a civilized liberal democracy, majorities owe certain things to harmless minorities. Tolerance, civility, and the rights affirmed in the Constitution. Freedom of speech, assembly, etc. However, it seems to me that minorities owe something to the majority in return. Mainly, a proper respect for their tastes, beliefs and sensibilities, and a decent restraint in challenging them, if there are some reasonable grounds for challenging them. This contract imposes some costs on minorities, of course, but I think they should look on those costs as the price of the tolerance they enjoy. Is that patronising? Well then, add being patronised to the list of costs. None of which, in any case I can think of, in American society today, is much more arduous or oppressive than that. There are, after all, reciprocal costs on the majority when they make those accommodations. End of quote from myself. At the time, I thought I was writing something reasonable and fair. I see now that, in fact, nothing could be more at odds with the spirit of the age. My views, as I've just quoted them, were hopelessly quaint and old-fashioned. The general expectation in Western societies nowadays is that people of the majority, whites, heterosexuals, Christians, should rip out our internal organs and stomp on them if that's what minorities want us to do. The ground rules are that minorities, blacks, homosexuals, Muslims, are always right and must be appeased at all costs. That's what I meant by minoritarianism. Britain is much further down the road of fanatical minoritarianism than the USA, though we're all headed in the same direction. Here's a story to illustrate the point. If you're a devout Muslim, you can't eat pork, and meat that you do eat has to come from animals slaughtered in a certain way. The slaughter has to be carried out with a blade, wielded by a Muslim who murmurs the name of Allah while doing the act. The animal must not be aware of other animals slaughtered nearby, e.g. by smelling their blood. Meat produced according to these rules is called halal. There's nothing objectionable about those rules in themselves, unless, of course, you like ham, pork chops or bacon, which I personally do. Muslims should be free to adhere to them, just as Jews have always been free to follow their dietary laws. No problem with any of that. Recently, though, there have been a spate of news stories over there about schools and fast food chains like Subway switching to halal meat for all their customers. Sample headlines, quote, "A stealthy takeover of Britain's supermarket shelves. Unlabeled halal meat has become the default position." Quote, "Now halal sneaks into our schools. Parents angered by move by councils to ban pork sausages and bacon and replace them with ritually slaughtered meat." Quote, "Pizza Express," that's another fast food chain, "Pizza Express reveal all the chicken they use is halal, but they don't tell customers unless they ask staff." Here's columnist Brendan O'Neill writing in the London Daily Telegraph, quote, "The thinking seems to be that it's better to make every Brit eat halal meat than it is to risk one Muslim accidentally eating non-halal meat. The food-related sensitivities of 4.8% of the British population should apparently trump the right of the other 95% to choose whether to chomp birds cut up before death or after death. We're entering an era of default halal, where more and more meat is made Muslim-friendly, just in case a Muslim should eat a non-Islamic chicken wing and kick up a storm." End quote. Minoritarianism. 5% of the population imposing their standards on the other 95%. Minoritarianism. It's the spirit of the age. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Remember Gene Robinson, the Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, who was openly homosexual? A traditionally minded Episcopalian of my acquaintance used to refer to him as the buggering bishop. Robinson's consecration as bishop in 2003, when I myself was still a practicing Anglican, split the American church. It went ahead, though. He became a bishop and stayed one for 9 years, stepping down from episcopal duties in 2012. In 2010, when New Hampshire legalized same-sex marriage, Robinson and his boyfriend got married. Well, now they're getting unmarried. In an email to the New Hampshire diocese, the buggering bishop announced he'll be seeking a divorce from the chap he's been living with for 25 years. It just didn't work out. Before moving in with this guy, Robinson had been married to a female person and had 2 children with her. He got a divorce from her too, so this will be his second. I can remember, it wasn't that long ago, I can remember when a man of the cloth was supposed to give an example to his flock by leading a restrained and godly life. It used to be considered scandalous for a minister to get divorced. Well, here's a bloke who will soon have been divorced twice from persons of both sexes. Oh, did I mention he's been treated for alcoholism too? Yet not only was this buffoon allowed to retain his dog collar, he was made a bishop. And they wonder why the churches are empty. Item, here's my gadget of the week, the flying 3D printer. I guess you've heard about 3D printers. They make three-dimensional objects by laying down layer after layer of some plastic or metal compound, according to a stored program. And I'm sure you've heard about personal drones, like the quadricopter thing you can buy at Brookstones for a few $100. Well, some imaginative engineers have put these two cutting-edge technologies together to make a drone that can repair bridges and such by hovering over them and spraying the repair material, or covering dangerous objects like nuclear waste with insulating foam, then picking them up and flying them off to somewhere safe. It all sounds like a bit of a stretch to me, and confirms my notion that technology is running out of ideas. Still, if they can hook it all up to a Segway somehow, I'll buy one. Item. Finally, a Darwin Award here to 43-year-old James Hunter of Portland, Oregon. Mr. Hunter removed himself from the gene pool early on the morning of May 4th. He was struck and killed by a car while doing push-ups in the middle of a busy road, stark naked. The news report says that, quote, the Oregon State Medical Examiner will conduct an autopsy, including toxicology, to determine the pedestrian's cause of death, end quote. If they'd like to save themselves a few $100, I think I could write that toxicology report for them without leaving my desk. There you have it, ladies and gents. Another week, another $17 billion on the national debt. While in New York last week, I had the pleasure of attending a performance of Rossini's Cenerentola at the Metropolitan Opera, with the beautiful and talented American soprano Joyce DiDonato in the title role. Cenerentola is just the Italian for Cinderella, and that's what the opera is, the Cinderella story, minus the fairy godmother, the pumpkin, and all the other magical stuff. If opera's not your thing, just let me explain the difference between 19th century German opera and 19th century Italian opera. In 19th century German opera, you get gods and spirits, dragons and dwarves, magic bullets, ghost ships, guys turning into swans, myths and magic. In 19th century Italian opera, you get people. People like ourselves, doing the people things that you and I do. Chasing the opposite sex, mostly. Opera-wise, the Italians are the humanists. The Germans are the mystics. So, Cenerentola is Cinderella minus the magic. A thing I like about this opera is that the best aria is right at the end. So, even if it's not a great production, you have something to look forward to. To see us out, here is Joyce DiDonato herself, singing a wee bit of that aria. Nacqui al affanno al pianto. I was born to sorrow and tears. But hey, everything's worked out fine. More from Radio Derb next week.